Aldred, we've got a lot to get through to this morning, so we're going to get into this discussion because I think this interview might be longer than usual, but that's okay because it is a very important topic that we need to be talking about. There is an article that has gone around and circulated in the psychology world, and it's all about research and the controversy whether gaming is beneficial or harmful in developing brain development, that is. What is the latest research and what does it have to say?
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Birgitta. Yes, thank you for the opportunity to be here once again. Yes, how about the scripture this morning, James 1 verse 5? I was actually listening to it on my way here and thinking, wow, you know, if we lack wisdom, we have to ask God. But the thing is, you know, we have access to so much knowledge, but we have so little wisdom these days, you know, and that's an interesting thing the way you think about it. But yes, when we come to the research part of gaming, it's a very controversial subject. I've read a lot of articles, the latest one specifically, and it's always interesting when you read these articles, you know, to see the way they actually present their information to you, or the deductions, in other words. The latest article was actually written or done by the University of Vermont, released in October this year. And it was actually the biggest sample that was done, and children ages 9 to 10 years old of 2,000 participants. So it's quite a big sample, all right? And then they compared the gamers to the non-gamers, and then the game time, as noted in the article, was 21 hours per week. Right. So there's a lot of deductions, but the thing is, when we come back to previous research articles that actually stated that gaming is good for you, the wording they normally use, for example, is gaming might improve the cognitive skills. So that's kind of misleading, because how many cognitive skills do you actually have? And this obviously, you know, it impresses parents, and the gamers are obviously justified by this and think, well, okay, but research actually proves that there's a cognitive benefit to my gaming. But if you look at the cognitive skills listed, it improves spatial and visual orientation, improves reaction time, it improves multitasking or task switching, and then working memory, which is a part of your short-term memory. Now you have to ask yourself this question. In a classroom setup, how are these cognitive skills functional to a learning student? If you think about something like visual orientation, not applicable. Reaction time, not applicable. Multitasking, not only applicable, but actually, you know, it works in the opposite direction, because a learner has to focus on specific information. The last thing you want is task switching occurring. And then, obviously, working memory, which is short-term memory. And you really want to focus on long-term memory and retention. So, yes, you have to ask yourself the question, are these attributes functional to a developing brain? So this is what I would like to, the listeners to just realize. You know, when you look at these things, always read the fine print on why they say the things that they do say. And then to get back to that newest study, very controversial. We've heard it on a lot of stations these days discussing, but it might be good for us. But the thing is, there is a lot of pitfalls, or if we're going to be diplomatic about it, vulnerabilities about this study.
What is your opinion on this? You have vast amounts of information. You know, there's different articles. Some are pro.
Yes.
Like you just said, this article that that is a lot of research, ages 9 to 10, hours of 21 hours a week, that is, of gaming, and a sample of 2,000 children.
Yes.
What is your opinion, Aldred?
Okay, it's quite a big and substantial sample, so that's a good thing. But now, if you look at the potential vulnerabilities in this study, if you look at the age factor, okay, so there's a quote in the study that actually says, in children aged 2 to 70 years old, a large 2022 survey was done in the US to show that 71% of these children play games between the ages of 2 to 7. Now, bringing it back to this latest research article, the participants there was between 9 and 10 years old. So what about the other criteria. Now, obviously, you have to allow for what we call neuroplasticity in developing brain. In other words, the way the brain is going to develop and how the brain actually changes its function in relation to the specific activity that you do. So another fact to remember here is that the prefrontal cortex in your brain is only fully developed between the ages of 20 to 25 years old. So the prefrontal cortex is a part of the brain that is responsible for inhibition control. So this is the thing they actually said in the results. They actually mentioned there that gaming has been shown to be beneficial in the area of inhibition control, but the prefrontal cortex is only fully developed between 20 to 25 years old. So that's kind of a
contradiction.
Yes, a kind of a gray area there. And obviously, we need to understand one thing. A study like this needs to be replicated at a later stage to accommodate for a normal brain development in the long term. So if you're going to look at the results now, you have to replicate the study later on in about 1 or 2 or 3 years to actually see the change that has occurred in the brain. So that's one of the pitfalls. Second one is the period of exposure to the gaming. So they noted there that the game time was 21 hours per week. But now you have to ask yourself the question, okay, so but how long did they expose these games to the 21 hours per week, right? So the article says the data was analyzed between October 2019 and October 2020. Again, what does it mean that the data was analyzed in 1 year? It doesn't say the study that they had exposure of 1 year. The data was analyzed for 1 year. Okay? So now it might show increased activity, okay, but this does not allow for the inevitable long term effects of dopamine on the areas with increased activity. So last week we explained the effect of dopamine. But now the thing about dopamine functions over a long term exposure. So yes, initially the functional MRI might show increased activity because it definitely stimulates that area of the brain because of increased dopamine. But long term exposure to dopamine can actually lead to neuron death, which we actually refer to as excitotoxicity. So now, long term, you have neurons dying, but now it shows there's an increased activity. That's the second pitfall. Third one is the interpretation of the functional MRI studies. So, very interesting here is that you can see that results, they show increased activity in areas like the prefrontal cortex and limbic system, and then because they show increased activity, a deduction was made, but because there's increased activity, it should lead to increase in inhibition control and increase in memory, right? But now the interesting thing is, as I explained to you about dopamine last week, dopamine has got four pathways. Two of those pathways is direct deposit of dopamine into the prefrontal cortex and the limbic system. So those two areas will show increase in activity because of dopamine activity in the areas. So in this MIT article, very interesting, where they actually explain about the functional MRI, they say in that article that although a functional MRI might show increased activity, it cannot tell you what kind of activity, number one, and it also cannot tell you which neurons. So again, misleading, all right? So we need to allow the effect of dopamine and glutamate and the excitatory interaction that can actually misconstrue the interpretation of results regarding perceived increased activity. So we need to replicate the study later on to see long-term exposure to dopamine and glutamate and then see what kind of physical changes occurred in that study. And then the last one is the methods of testing. As I was saying, is it functional? Are the testing methods functional? For example, they used scientific questionnaires on paper to get their information. Now, let me ask you a question. If you think about things like inhibition control and working memory, right? How can you, on a questionnaire, get a good idea of how these things should work. My opinion would be, if you're looking at inhibition control and you are presenting someone a questionnaire in a calm, controlled environment, obviously you're not going to get true results. My idea would be, put them in that stressful environment with adrenaline pumping, and then we can talk about
it. Make it more practical.
Practical and functional, exactly. And obviously also with working memory. Working memory, as seen on a questionnaire, how is that functional? How do you test that in a functional classroom environment? So that would be my main pitfalls of this study.
Aldred, when you say the effect that in function is related to an area of the brain that is affected, what exactly do you mean, just in layman's terms?
Okay, that's a good question. Okay, so it's important to link up detrimental long-term effects to the detrimental physical changes in the affected brain areas, as every area is responsible for a specific function. In other words, we can say that an area is function-specific. So there was a very good study done in March 2020, two weeks exposure of 5 hours per day game time. And this study actually proved it resulted in a decreased volume and decreased density of both the white and the gray matter in certain areas of the brain. And then went on and explained how these findings related to negative effects in brain function. Now we're talking about a whole different ballgame, because they've proved there's decreased volume, decreased density in both gray and white matter. It's not what might happen. This is actually what happened. So obviously, if you decrease in brain matter, what do you think is going to happen? So that, to me, in the areas they discussed relating to this article was the prefrontal cortex. So that, as I said, the prefrontal cortex responsible for inhibition control and higher executive function. For example, problem solving and personality. So if there's a decrease in volume and density in the prefrontal cortex, you can think about, obviously, there needs to be a problem in inhibition control and higher executive function. And how many kids you know playing games have problems with problem solving or task sequencing? You tell them, Johnny, go upstairs, put on your clothes, come downstairs and sit at the table and we're going to have dinner. And Johnny will stare at you, okay, what did you just say? Because that proves to you there's no sequencing of tasks. The second area involved was the thalamus. Now, the thalamus is the relay center of the brain. Now, we think about this. All the stimulus comes into your body through the sensory cortex and everything. Now, you suddenly have an overload in the thalamus. You have decreased density. So now, the potential of the thalamus to send the impulses to the right areas of the brain is compromised. Now you have a child presenting with ADHD. They don't know what to do with these stimulus. It's overloading a compromised thalamus. And the thalamus' other function is, its function is in sleep, wakefulness, consciousness, learning, and memory. So now you have decreased volume in the thalamus. There has to be problems with learning, memory, sleep, and wakefulness. How many kids you know struggle to sleep nowadays? I have to go on melatonin just to try and deal with that. Third area is the limbic system. The limbic system basically consists out of the amygdala and the hippocampus. And this is actually the trauma center of the brain. Interesting, because now, let me give you an example. If you're 5 years old, you run into the kitchen, you put your hand on a hot plate, okay? You're going to burn your hand. You are never going to do that again. It doesn't matter if someone pays you R1,000, you're not going to do that again. So what happens here is, as you put your hand on the hot plate, those stimulus go to your sensory cortex. That communicates with your amygdala. And the amygdala is the area of the brain that actually puts meaning to your frightful and threatening stimulus in the brain. So now the amygdala says, look here. This was not a good idea. Now the amygdala lights up the hippocampus, and the hippocampus stores that as a long-term memory. So that's a trauma center. So if there's a decreased volume in the limbic system, like the amygdala and the hippocampus, that means that your ability to handle trauma is compromised. How many kids nowadays struggle with anxiety and have problems with dealing with trauma. Other functions is the processing of emotions and obviously behavioral regulation. And how many kids you know struggle with interpreting the emotions they go through nowadays? Most people, what happens with the kids nowadays, they are put on very, very high dosages of Concerta. It makes them numb. So now even the medication makes them numb, and they can't even interpret the emotions they're supposed to go through. And the last area is the parietal lobes. Parietal lobes function, the perception of emotions, language, mathematical, and body image. Decreased volume parietal lobes, you can have problems with perception of emotions, language, mathematical problems. So if your kid's mathematical scores drop 20%, this is the problem. And body image. How many kids you know nowadays struggle with body dysmorphia? They're not happy with the way they look. They're anorexic or whatever. So you can see basically from this, this actually shows you in a very clear perspective what the effects of gaming is on the areas of the brain. So in my opinion, at the end of the day, we have to rather look at first-hand evidence of how gaming adversely affects behavior. Because the thing is, we can always go back to research, and you can interpret research just the way you want, subjective or objective. But when we actually do, well, actually in conversations with these people, the parents come to us telling us that my kid has got a problem with his behavior because of gaming. So the proof is in the pudding.
Elder De Beer, a most interesting discussion on today, debating and discussing and looking at the different viewpoints of whether gaming is good for you or not. Thank you so much, Aldred. We look forward to next week's edition of Digital Dilemma.